Welcome. That's the first day of Black Hat. I'm very happy to be here among fellow researchers and friends, loads of friends. And I hope for the next 1 hour. By the way, I'm completely knackered from my actually traveling from London. So I'm in a completely different time zone, and I feel like it's really late now. So I hope that for the next 1 hour, I'll be as much entertaining as possible. And also that you'll be able to get something out of this talk. So it's going to be helpful. First of all, my name is Petko Petkov. Some of you may recognize me as PDP, which is the acronym of my full name. And I'm associated with various kinds of things and doing all sorts of experiments which are not important today to talk about. But what is important is to talk about client-side security. The thing is that the first time when I took this talk, I was taking this talk to Black Hat Amsterdam, and I was actually very unsure what the title should be, because the fact is that I'm talking about client-side security, but also I'm talking about things which are most of them actually design flaws, design issues. So I was thinking maybe I should call it design bugs or something like this, or maybe I should call the talk something like security, like sort of a simple security bugs, because a lot of the things that we're going to see today are quite simple to explain, and I often compare them to magic tricks. The magic trick, most of the time, the thing is, the important thing in the magic trick is the actual performance, it's not the trick itself. The trick is actually quite simple. But the thing is that we cannot actually, until we actually see what the trick is, we are very impressed, and when we see the trick, we are actually disappointed because it's simple. The same thing is, for example, with a lot of the things. So I think the title client-side security is good enough, and this is what we're going to concentrate today, but we're going to also pay attention to all these other things, such as simplicity and all other philosophies, which I actually feel very passionate about. Today, before we actually move this into this client sort of a thing, we need to kind of have a little bit discussion about clients and servers and the new ways of doing attacks and old ways of doing attacks, and this first diagram shows how we used to do things. And we are still doing them, and I call this this era the era of the razor sharp exploits. We pretty much have a bad guy attacks the good guy, and if the attack was successful, it's a game over. So it's a really sharp exploit, and most of the time we're concentrating on the server side technologies. The reason we used to concentrate most of the time on server side technologies is because the client side was not mature enough. The client side has started to develop like 5 years ago with richer technologies, with all this new sort of a ways of doing things with technologies such as Java and Flash and all this Ajax stuff. And also Firefox has a great contribution to this era. But this is the old way of doing it. This is still pretty much if you find a bug like that, you pretty much win the game, no matter what. However, in the new world, in the world of client-side security, things are not as straightforward. In fact, sometimes we need to sort of imagine or create a tactical design the whole attack. Basically, create a strategy how the attack should work. So in most of the cases, we have the bad guy who uses the good guy to attack himself or to attack a third guy. So things get a little bit more twisted. And with some of the stuff that we're going to see today, you will see that often we combine like various types of technologies. Each one of them individually is secure enough, but when we put them together, they create insecure condition. So this is basically what we're going to talk about today. But before even moving into this sort of thing, I need to talk to you a little bit about this client sort of a server relationship. And I'm very happy that I actually saw the keynote today, because it is very close to what my philosophy is about these things. We often, in the penetration testing world and the security world, we take systems out of context, we test them, we find some vulnerabilities in them, and we put them back into the context. But the thing is that we cannot just, test in these systems individually. We need to take also the system, the systems which in they exist with other systems they interact with. I often say the clients and servers are in relationship, they're in symbiosis. They're actually security models is often shared. Not often, actually all the time is shared. So the security of an individual client often depends on the security of the service it communicates with, and also the security of A server depends on the security of the individual clients it communicates with. So just to give you an example, if you listen down to DNS talk, pretty much we have a server-side flaw, which when exploited successfully leads to a lot of client-side problems. It doesn't lead to much problems on the server itself. On the other hand, if you have a very, very secure VPN solution, which requires the user to use a strong group password, and also you have a token, all that interesting and good security mechanisms, but the client itself was in an insecure Wi-Fi network, in which case the attacker gained access and installed, I don't know, maybe DNS tunnel from where they can execute the commands and all, like, establish the communication. As soon as this client gets back to the VPN network, you know, now you're actually dropping an insecure client into a secure net, through a secure server. So you have, again, that special relationship. And we can see that relationship everywhere. The thing is that the last time when I presented this talk, that was in Amsterdam, and then I presented in a couple of other conferences, just as Hack in the Box. To be honest with you, I basically had a lot of vulnerabilities in 50 slides, and I was rushing through all these vulnerabilities, and I'm trying to show how all of these vulnerabilities work. And my general idea was to actually send a message about the types of vulnerabilities. This time, I'm going to do the same, but now I put them under categories. So I hope that the presentation is going to flow much smoothly, and it's going to be as boring as last time, because if you look at it from a psychological perspective, somebody bombards you with too much information, you actually fall asleep. It's actually very valid denial of service attacks for your brain. So we can actually look into a couple of acronyms, which I needed to invent myself, and I hope that nobody uses them. But actually, we're going to use these acronyms as a guide. The first types of attacks that we're going to look today, I call them cross-context request forgeries, and some of you who actually recognize the cross-site request forgery attack probably already know what we're actually going to talk about today. But I actually choose the word context because it has a special meaning. When we're actually talking about cross-site scripting or cross-site request forgeries, we often restrict ourselves in the domain of sites. But that's the reality is that there is a lot more than just the sites. We have application-to-application types of attacks. We have protocol-to-protocol, protocol-to-application, and we have many types of combinations. So if we restrict ourselves in the domain of web applications, then we're going to just stay there. But these attacks are equally applicable everywhere. So we're going to discuss basically cross-site request forgeries, but we're going to look at them from many types of angles. The first type of angle is going to be a typical cross-site request forgery attack. And in this one, just to illustrate what actually means to those of the public who actually don't know it yet. To me, cross-site request forgeries is the biggest design bug of all time. And it's not fixable. It's not like we can add some special stuff to the browser and we suddenly is going to fix it. No, this is how the way the web works. It works based on the top of cross-site request forgeries attacks, which we now employ as a form of attack. Which means that every time you click on a link, that's a request forgery. Every time you do a PayPal transaction, that's a request forgery. Every time you do social bookmarking or any of that sort, that's a request forgery. That's what request forgers rely on, which means that we cannot actually fix them. We have to live with them. So the only way to fix them is to actually improve the way we program code. So this is the first example, which illustrates a simple cross-site request forgery attack, which leads to catastrophe. The attack falls like this. The user logs into their Gmail. They visit a malicious website while still logged into their Gmail. And invisibly, of course, this third screen just shows you the result. But invisibly, the malicious user adds a filter into the filter list of the Gmail client, which basically instructs every new email that should arrive on that inbox and has an attachment. In this case, I just used that sort of a rule set. And has an attachment will be forwarded to the attacker. Now, the email itself is not going to disappear, but there will be a copy sent to the attacker. So this is a very valid and very, it's sort of a persistent backdoor within your email client. Because now we're moving into this web-enabled world, we're going to see more of this type of attacks. This is a simple cross-site request forgery, which also Google has prevented, they try to protect from. But the protection, which usually involves adding a tokenized identifier within the form. The token was there, but there was not sufficient checks. So although it first, when you look at the source code, it seems that there is a protection, but when you actually try to perform the attack, you see that there isn't any. But luckily, it got fixed, and we are happy. Now, there's other types of cross-site request forgery attacks. And the thing is that they actually expand just beyond websites. We can go even to this sort of a thing where we attack even routers. And we found many types of vulnerabilities, especially earlier this year, we're actually doing this router hacking challenge where we're actually looking for a lot of vulnerabilities in routers. The devices that's the first device that you use to connect to your internet, whether that's going to be a Wi-Fi, ADSL, like whatever kind of, doesn't matter what kind of a router. We found a lot of vulnerabilities in the BT Home Hub, in which case we could actually overwrite any setting in the BT Home Hub, completely own it with a single request. And we found even esoteric types of vulnerabilities, such as the cross-site request forgery within the Snop VoIP phone. Now, this type of vulnerability actually instructs the VoIP phone to create a conversation between the phone and any arbitrary number that we provide. It could be actually a SIP address. The interesting thing here is that the phone does not indicate that there is a connection has been established. And it puts also the phone in a speaker mode. So essentially we turn a phone, a VoIP phone, into a very powerful bug, very powerful device which now can survey the room where the phone is. And again, there is no indication that this conversation has happened, so the user visits the website, and suddenly everybody can listen what's going on in the room. But we move forward, and a different type of attack, which is based on this type of a technology, right, is an attack which affects file upload facilities. Now, we found also, when we were examining these routers, and we found that not only in the routers itself, but also across the web, nobody actually doing anything about file upload facilities. The reason that is because file upload facilities work slightly different from the traditional types of requests we usually send from our browser. We have a get and post request. They're based on certain types of encoding mechanisms. The file upload is based on a completely different type of encoding mechanism. Often, developers actually don't do anything about these file upload facilities, and they don't do anything to prevent cross-site request forgery attacks. We try to find a way around basically this to exploit them, and it's not very easy to exploit these attacks from the browser because the browser does not have the facilities to actually provide to exploit this attack. But Flash does. So often say if the browser restricts you in one area, then probably Flash is a good substitute for that area or even Java. When you put all these technologies together, Flash, Java, and the browser, we have suddenly no restrictions whatsoever. The restrictions get lost, the same origin policy is broken. In this particular case, we're using a simple application which is written in MXML, I think, or MX something. It's the new Flex engine for Adobe Flash. This application forges a simple request to a file upload facilities. In this case, we're actually uploading a config file to a router. We also managed to upload a whole firmware to the router. So basically, imagine the scenario, you go visit the website, suddenly that malicious website uploads a new firmware in your router and you don't actually see anything happening there. As soon as the attack is completed, and if your router does not crash and completely renders your router useless, if the attack succeeds, now the attackers completely rooted to your router. They have a complete access to this router, and in some cases, the routers are based on open standards, such as Linux. They'll be able to easily decompile it to actually, you know, unarchive it, put more stuff in, put more backdoors, and, you know, create a new, actually, firmware, which, once backdoored, is going to allow them to get into your network. So file upload facilities can be exploited using this cross-site request forgeries. But even gets even better. How about exploiting any type of device, regardless whether it is a router, or maybe it could be, I don't know, your Xbox. It could be your phone. My phone actually supports something known as UPnP. And also it could be your fridge in the future, because UPnP was designed for the purpose of technologies. When you drop these technologies into a network, these technologies should be able to interact with each other. And not only that, they should be able to know what each technology is. So for example, if I drop a printer, and if I drop my fridge, and if I want to print, I don't know, the context of the fridge, I should click on a button that should go to my printer and get printed. That combination, that thing should happen automatically. I should not spend time actually setting it up. So UPnP is a very powerful stack of technologies. And before our research, a lot of people believed that it's not possible to attack UPnP, mainly because one of these technologies that is in the UPnP stack is the Simple Discovery Protocol, which is based on multicast clouds. Now, multicast is not routable, of course. And of course, we need to have an Ethernet, like local LAN access to the network in order to start playing with UPnP. But also, what a lot of people didn't recognize is that the last technology in the UPnP stack is SOAP, and SOAP is based on HTTP. Now, we were looking for ways to exploit SOAP requests over the web. So you should actually visit a website, and that website should take control of your router using a simple SOAP request. And it turns out that although the browser does not provide with the features which are required such a thing to actually happen, right? Flash does. So in order to actually forge a request, we basically need to create a simple application in Flash, create the SOAP payload, which is encoded here in Euro encoding, I believe it's base64. No, it's Euro encoded. And then we need to supply a special header, which is the SOAP action. SOAP action is a special header. Of course, the browser does not allow me to provide special headers when I do request forgeries, but Flash does. And because of that, now we have an attack vector. Now, everybody can actually take this thing and turn it into a very powerful sort of attack, because a lot of routers have very weird features. Through UPnP, sometimes it's possible to change the DNS settings on the router. And of course, this is unauthenticated. You're never going to get prompted with username and password or any sort of anything like this. It's completely unauthenticated. So in this case, we're using actually a web technology attacking a router. Through web, of course. So if you can call, it request like site forgery or something, but I like to use the word context forgery. And some of the attacks which I'm going to talk about later, they're forms of cross context forgeries, but also fit in another category which I'm going to talk later, which is called command fixation attacks or parameter fixation attacks. But we're going to move on, and we're going to actually talk a little bit now of this cross context scripting. Now, the thing is that about cross-site scripting, and I think there's a lot of misunderstandings about this type of attack, is that when we say site, we often think that we're going to exploit site A through site B. The thing is that even when we exploit site A through site B, this is not even site-to-site exploitation. We're actually exploiting the same origin policies. So even saying cross-site scripting is not correct. We should say cross-origin scripting or something like this. Site scripting is completely bogus, and in fact, when we come out, I don't know, when we actually, all of us agreed to use this term, we made a huge mistake, because these cross-site scripting attacks, they exist everywhere, in a different forms, in a different types of weird combinations. The first one, I'm going to show you again, a simple cross-site scripting attack. We're going to take this one, it's going to lift it, and we're going to actually see how this thing applies to other types of technologies through vulnerabilities which are quite real, and we've been discussed before. The first one is actually happening in a website. Most of you probably don't know, but it's not such a big thing, but it's a weird type of a cross-site scripting attack, which requires a little bit of more imagination, just the traditional ones. This is a persistent like cross-site scripting attack, and as with other cross-site scripting attacks, we can inject like weird characters, metric characters such as greater than or less than. The only problem in this type of attack is that we are restricted only to 10 characters. Now, if you try to inject something in 10 characters, you will see that it's not possible to do anything interesting in these 10 characters. You cannot even inject script source equal to something. You don't have space for that. But what we can do now, we can leverage the weird nature of the browsers and the way browsers actually render forms and render HTML. We can take that and we can trick the browser to render chunks of our code in a such a way that actually meaningful. So we can actually split the website into chunks. Some of these chunks contain our script injection sort of thing. Other chunks contain just pure data which does not have meta characters. Now, this attack is known as fragmented cross-site scripting attacks, and it works by actually commenting out blocks of HTML. So when we actually inject the whole thing, we don't inject it in a single field. We inject it like in a couple of places, a little pieces. So we inject here one thing, here another thing, and here another thing. The browser is going to render the whole thing, but when the whole page renders, the parts that are in between is going to kind of cancel each other. So one's going to be left is our real code. So this is the weird nature of this attack. And of course, we have a cross-site scripting condition. It's easy to understand. We've seen that already. It's not such an interesting thing. This was the result, by the way, of the attack. Of course, it was not intended to be malicious. But we can actually go a little bit further. And I'm not going to talk a lot about this topic, because there will be another talk, I think, tomorrow, that's going to go much into the details of that sort of attack. And, of course, probably a lot of you have heard of this thing. It's called GIFAR thing. It was across the most of the media outlets lately. So here's an example. We have two technologies which are, by themselves, not that important. We have the JPEG image. Well, they're important, but not that malicious. Right? We have the JPEG image, and we have the zip file. We also, in the Java world, is called jar, which is a Java archive file. Now, what happens is that if we take an image file and a jar file and we put them together, we create a hybrid file. The reason it is hybrid, you can try the following. Take a JPEG, take a zip file, put them together, then just stuck them together next to each other. And the JPEG should be the first half, the zip file is going to be the second half. Rename the file to something.jpg, double-click is going to open as image, view it in your browser is going to open as a simple image. If you try to detect whether this is an image file by using file utility or using any of this image manipulation library, it's going to tell you that this is a valid JPEG image. But if you change the extension from .jpg to .zip and double-click it, it's going to open as a folder. So it's a JPEG file and zip folder, zip archive at the same time. Now, when I presented this thing for the first time in Black Hat Amsterdam, I didn't exactly know why this thing works, because I was lazy enough not to research it. But FX from the Phone Elite group, after the talk, he actually told me that the reason this thing works is because the headers of both files are in different locations. So the headers of the JPEG image are on the top of the file, of the head, and the headers of the zip archive is at the bottom. So actually, parsers are going to go different ways. So the first parser is going to start rendering like this, the second parser is going to start actually reading like that. And because of this sort of a thing, we now can create a hybrid file. Now, why this thing matters? It matters because a lot of websites, a lot of places, not only websites, don't think about websites only, think about anywhere we can put an image. Could be a website, could be some application that you're using, could be instant messaging client, could be anything, it doesn't matter what it is. The thing is, what matters here is that we create a jar file. We actually ship a jar file into some location. So we actually upload an image file into some web server, suddenly that web server now hosts an applet. So that applet now can actually access certain things. And I said, for more information, you can actually go visit the talk tomorrow. Nathan and the ex-Sniper's crew, they actually have prepared some stuff against Google. And they're going to explain how exactly it works in that context. But this is basically a form of persistent cross-site scripting attack, and also a form of a applet or whatever you want, jar executable, getting shipped onto the client side. And that applet or that Java executable file has a lot of access when run from the file system than actually run from the web as a full access. Another type of a cross-site sort of a context scripting attack is basically this sort of issue which happened to be in Firefox. Not that long time ago, it was possible to mislead the browser to actually think that certain URLs originate from different origins. So in this very simple attack, we basically trick the browser by using something called, you see how this jar thing has been reused everywhere? And this is something that I actually want to bring to much later, that we are reusing technologies, and so as a result, we actually bring issues from their world into a different world of this technology we use. So here, we're using jar files. With jar files in Firefox, we can actually specify the location of a file that is within that jar archive that should be rendered. But because at that time there was insufficient checks within the Firefox browser, it was possible to create a condition where, for example, I can host a file, a jar archive on my server, and then I can actually say, using Google, for example, and the 302 redirect in Google, I can say, okay, go fetch that file, and it's going to just create a simple, 302 redirect with location. And then if I stick this jar thing in front of it, basically tells the browser, render that archive, render the HTML from that archive, but the browser will think that this information comes from Google itself, although this, technically it doesn't come from Google, and it creates, again, an insecure condition. I'm not going to go into it. There's actually more important things to discuss. This is another form of actually cross-context scripting, and we are now getting more into actually exploiting the client itself, actually gaining access. I would say that it is enough if somebody compromises your Gmail account. It's a devastating effect. It's going to create a huge hassle for you because probably you'll never be able to actually get it back. So it's enough for someone actually hacking your online identity to actually cause tons of problems. But we can even actually hack the client. So in this case, we use QuickTime to attack Firefox. Now, QuickTime has this feature, which is called QuickTime Media Links. The things about QuickTime Media Links is that they're almost like glue files, and they can have any type of an extension. You can think of the QuickTime Player support. So we can have a QuickTime file, which is, as you can see on the top of the example, this is a simple XML file. But this XML, this simple XML file can have any extension. It can have an extension .avi, .move, .mp3, .mp4, anything that we can play in QuickTime Player. Now this file, basically, again, it's a simple meta file. It just instructs what movies should be played into the player. But it has also a special parameter, which is called the QTNext. QTNext parameter instructs the browser to open a certain URL when you finish playing those files. The only problem is because QuickTime was initially developed for the Apple platform and was later ported to the Windows platform, there wasn't much understandings about what is really secure in this case. As I said, both technologies are developed in a completely different context, and they were put together thinking that they're actually going to work together really nicely, but they don't work nice. In this example, because QuickTime takes the whole thing into their hands, we'll be able to inject commands within when the browser starts. So we can inject parameters. We can inject parameters when the browser starts. So we can specify something called Chrome. By the way, this is does not work anymore because Firefox actually removed that Chrome thing just to ensure that other applications cannot do the same thing. And there was actually a plethora of applications that actually can do exactly the same thing. And not only QuickTime, but because they removed it now, it's much safer. But anyway, we could have actually provided something like dash Chrome and just instruct the browser to interpret the next string as a URL that will be executed in the Chrome zone. The Chrome zone is the most privileged zone in the Firefox browser. All your extensions, the browser itself runs within the Chrome, which means that we have a complete access to the XP.com primitives within the browser. We can create files, launch applications, modify the browser itself, install extensions, backdoor the whole process, install a sniffer within the browser if you want, anything. In this case, we're actually running a simple command, the calculator, just to prove that it works. And it does work. But it gets even more interesting. Are there actually other extensions that we can compromise in similar ways? And the thing is that, yeah, there are actually tons of extensions. And even a couple of days ago, Mario, another member of our group, actually he showed me a problem within a popular, which I wasn't aware of, but apparently it's a very popular extension for developers, especially in Germany, where he's based. And this extension allows you to run tests, so you can actually check your application for whether it's actually been written correctly or not. But this extension actually has a Chrome execution problem, so in a similar way to the Firebug. Firebug is a popular extension for Firefox, mainly used by developers. Yeah, it's not widely used by people, but I would say if developers are using it, that's a perfect way of gaining access to some popular products, and maybe even backdoor the source code to these products once you get access to these developers' boxes. The Firebug has a problem, context scripting problem, where we'll be able to jump from the context of the web page, which is the origin is going to be HTTP or something like this, into the context of the Chrome, or the origin of the Chrome. Between them, there should not be any interactions, otherwise this creates a security problem. Using something like this, here I illustrate how we inject the payload. The payload is basically a simple sort of a chopping exercise where we actually push back into the Chrome zone a function. That function actually allows us to run files. We need to run a couple of this sort of a commands in order to actually put the whole thing into the Chrome basically zone. Once we do that, we can write another function, which in this case I call just function execute. And that function does exactly the same thing as we did before, but actually does it automatically. It does the chopping automatically. And then while we're still in the browser, now we can do something as simple as just saying execute calculator.exe. So we have now a super user-friendly function, which we've created ourselves, that is, when you visit a website, that website will be able to do all this stuff, or used to, and then launch applications. Again, you can do a lot more than that. This just illustrates the attack. But it gets even better. The thing is that a lot of, I'm saying that this Ajax thing and this Firefox thing and, you know, basically contributed to the rise of these rich technologies. The reason I'm saying is that because we are reusing them. We actually reuse monsters. And actually, I don't blame ourselves because nobody wants to reinvent the wheel over and over again. So, for example, imagine an instant messaging client. Every time I see an instant messaging client, I see only one thing. I see Internet Explorer. Because the instant messaging client, all of them, GTalk, Skype, AIM, all of them, are based on Internet Explorer. The reason is because nobody wants to actually go through the hassle of creating a interface where you can render smiley faces or do underline or blinking text or even embed a video. I mean, the browser already can do that. Why the hell we don't actually use it in our application? And when we actually type our messages, what we render there is actually HTML. Fair enough. But the problem is that when we embed this Internet Explorer thing, we are actually, and most of the developers who developed this instant messaging client, they was not aware that they're embedding an insecure version of Internet Explorer, the unsandboxed version, the pure version of Internet Explorer. The pure version of Internet Explorer allows you to do a lot of things. Internet Explorer is the standard component of the Windows operating system, and you can even actually create applications based entirely on Internet Explorer, and it's called HTML applications. These applications allow you to do a lot of things through ActiveX controllers such as the Windows Scripting House controllers such as WScript. In this case, we're using a vulnerability in a cross-site scripting vulnerability on, for example, a website such as Dailymotion or Metacafe, right? And then when we inject some code there, we create a cross-site scripting attack. But we are not interested in that. We're not interested in actually cross-site scripting Metacafe. That's not interesting. What we're interested in there is to put a little bit of a code which we will not execute in any sensible browser, because this code is purely malicious, purely requires a lot of privileges in order to run. So if you go there with Internet Explorer, it's not going to run, it's going to completely fail with a huge error message. However, if you force the user to actually open that page in some way, or even retrieve that information through their Skype player, which basically does not have the restrictions of the normal Internet Explorer browser, then suddenly this code works. So now we have a scripting condition that comes from the browser, goes into your Skype player or any other, you know, instant messenger or any of that sort, and now it's going to compromise your box. Because once we're able to run WScripting, like Windows scripting commands, we can do whatever the hell we want in the system. It's up to us to decide what we're going to do with it. This vulnerability was discovered. Part of it was discovered by Miroslav Luchinski, and the second part with the Metacafe is discovered by Avi Raff. It's actually very impressive research. But the thing is that it's even possible to go beyond that. How about actually injecting this stuff over the air? How about you are chatting with some guy on Skype or something, someone else, and then basically someone in the same network injects stuff into your Skype player and compromises you completely? It's possible because all these instant messaging clients, they're actually pulling ads from some external location. Now, in the case of Skype, these ads are coming in an encrypted format, so we cannot actually tamper them. However, these ads are Flash applications. Now, Flash itself probably can pull other stuff, such as graphics or more Flash files to render the ad, right? And this stuff actually don't go through HTTPS, or even if they go, there's no actually validation whether they're actually fetching it from the right server with the right SSL certificate. And most of the time, we can actually tamper it. Not most of the time, all of the time. So in the case of Skype, we actually can use tools such as AirPwn or Karma. So if we're in the local network and you have your Skype player running, such as in the background or something, then the attackers can actually attack you again and get access to the system. And with this thing, pretty much, we saw how we can actually shift from one context to another. And there's actually a lot more examples. There was one example with the AIM, I believe, which again, because it's based on the browsers, and browsers can actually render JavaScript, they can render images and those sorts of other things. Perhaps they can even render applets. So now, because of this, now we can actually combine, mix and match technologies. We can use one technology and put it into different contexts and actually take advantage of the environment, not taking into consideration that sort of combination. But it's getting even better.